By radiometry techniques, you'd be amazed how weak a signal could be, and you still can make a strip chart recording saying that when I wave the antenna across that signal, I can tell where it's coming from. So radio goes everywhere, and you just have to be smart enough to put up the right kind of equipment to get enough of that signal into a sensitive enough receiver with the right bandwidth and the right demodulation techniques, and you're going to be hear what's going on. Let me drop. Okay, a little bit later, because of a subject that Wesley brought up last week in 2XJN, if he's around at around 11 o'clock, I'm going to go back to a space subject that he brought up last week, and that is, if you are testing a spacecraft by putting it into a chamber that simulates space, where you take out the air, you bring it into what we call a high vacuum on Earth, and you'd be amazed how many particles are left inside of a high vacuum. And then you adjust the temperatures of the wall of the chamber. Can you adjust the temperature that your spacecraft will settle at, even though there is no air around, no air per se, around your spacecraft? No air per se around your spacecraft. And the answer is absolutely yes. Even without air, you can adjust the temperature of your spacecraft by adjusting the temperature of the walls of the chamber. And how that takes place is an interesting piece of physics. And so at around 11 o'clock or so, we might get into that. I think it's time to go over to, right on schedule, roughly 9 o'clock for the mailbag. And Paul, here we go, John, have these brand new scientists that are writing to you. Sent us any more of these questions that try to stump us, and periodically they do. And by the way, there's one other thing I want to mention. Roy, AC2GS, brought to my attention that I've often said that we make mistakes, and he brought to our attention that a definite mistake was made about 3 weeks ago. Let me jump. And that is, when you talk about individual atoms and molecules, it's obvious that when you look at the right reference, there are very simplistic diagrams that were made 40, 50 years ago of what the individual orbits of the electrons around a nucleus of an atom, what they look like. And in the early days, they drew it like a planetary system. All the electrons are in a simple disk going around that, like individual planets going around the sun, the electrons go around the nucleus. Well, it turns out at the molecular level, the electrostatic repulsion of those individual electrons, they repulse each other so much that each of their orbits is a very complicated pattern, that they essentially make a cloud of electrons around that nucleus. But when it comes to the simplest atom, hydrogen, where there's only one electron there, I speculated that electron would be in a simple planar orbit, and Roy brought to my attention that absolutely not. It still has a very complicated orbit. And at first I had trouble figuring out why. My best guess is that you never have a isolated hydrogen atom all by itself. He's always in a cloud of gas with all of his fellow hydrogen atoms. On top of that, he's never an isolated hydrogen atom. He's H2 and O2 and N2. In other words, pairs of them come together. So it isn't one single electron going around one single proton in one flat plane. It's still a complicated orbit, and I am guessing it's because of all of his adjacent neighbors that orbit becomes very complicated. If you could have one simple hydrogen atom all by itself, a very difficult experiment, would that hydrogen electron just be a simple planar orbit around that nucleus?
Repeater, timeout.
I could speculate about that, maybe, but right now all the information says no, so I was too simplistic on that one. Once again, if you think you understand Mother Nature, you probably don't understand the problem. In almost all cases, she's a hell of a lot more complicated than you think. So these guys are going to stump us. I see it coming, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go right ahead with the mailbag.
Comment in 1YDY.
Mr. YDY, go right ahead.
Just stick that, you know, it's
more a function of quantum mechanics. It predicts where the electron cloud will have its greatest propensity for the electron to be.
But Hank, let me ask you this question. The simplest, lowest energy I can think of an orbit, of an isolated hydrogen atom, if you could ever get that, not an H2, but an H, would be one planar orbit, the lowest possible orbit of an electron going around the single proton nucleus. In order for that orbit to become non-planar, for the electron to move in a non-planar orbit, somebody has to supply, let me call it a vertical force, to move him up and down, to make a change in the plane of orbit. Who is supplying that force? And you can use all-encompassing words saying quantum does that for you. What's the source of that force that's going to move him out of that plane? Back to you, Hank. And then we'll pick up Eric after that. You got it, Hank. K2LAW.
Dick, I think you're confusing the Bohr model, which is basically a method of predicting the amount of covalent energy that's required to fill up any particular shell in a shell of electrons in the prediction of a molecule with the quantum theory. And the quantum theory doesn't really say that it does it for you. What it really does is it talks about Heisenberg's uncertainty. The greater you know one of the features of any particular low-energy atom, your hydrogen atom. So the greater you know, say, the position of that particular electron, the less well you know its energy level or its speed, and vice versa. The greater you know its speed, the less well you know its position at any given time. So I think you're confusing two different, you know, methods of describing molecular activity, that's all. And one YDY.
I'm going to agree with you that any method of trying to make a measurement is going to drastically disturb the item that I'm trying to measure. But that's not my my hypothesis here. If I'm not making a measurement, if I'm leaving it alone, and at some later time I put it in a particle accelerator, and I start bombarding this guy, and if I do enough scatter experiments of enough hydrogen atoms, I can find out what is the probable distribution of the orbit of that lowest electron around that single hydrogen atom. Obviously, I'm saying a bunch of words here that roll off the tongue easily. To really do the experiment I'm describing, of course, would be extremely difficult. But if I didn't disturb it, is there any possibility that a isolated hydrogen atom could have a lowest energy electron orbit that is planar? Is that out of the possibility, Hank? Wait a minute now. I'm terrible on names. Yes, Hank. Go ahead, Hank. K2LIW.
Nick, first, I was very impressed that you got my name this time. Second, is my understanding is that it's not, there's no reason to assume that it's a planar orbit. You're not dealing, the weak electron force doesn't give you any reason to assume that it's truly in orbit. You're not dealing with gravity and anything that would give you the prediction of a planar orbit. You're really dealing with just simply the probability of where the electron is relative to the proton of the atom. And so really, when you're describing what you're describing, it sounds to me a lot like Schrodinger's cat. You don't know where the electron is until you make the effort to measure it, so to speak. And I'm really not sure that there's any real reason to believe that it's in a planar orbit to begin with. And one YDY. I could be wrong completely. I mean, but that's just my understanding. And one YDY.
I'm going to accept that, Hank, because I do have such an extremely hypothetical situation. A single hydrogen atom all by itself almost never exists that way. And I'm making a measurement in some kind of a way without disturbing it, and to try to figure out what was the orbit like, was it a planar orbit, before I made the measurement. I've got a whole bunch of, extreme hypotheses here. You and I are never going to make that measurement. We're maybe not even going to read about somebody else making the measurement, so it's probably academic. In all situations where the hydrogen atoms are at least in pairs, and there's a whole lot of other atoms in the cloud of hydrogen gas that they're part of. Obviously, a lot of interactions are taking place. All those orbits become very complicated. In the case of orbits of planets around the Sun, the 99.99% of the forces a planet experiences is the gravity of the Sun. That's a huge, massive object, and that planet is in orbit around that object. The interaction between the planets is so minor by comparison that when you study what happens after a long period of time, the planets around a star tend to eventually settle into planar orbits, where all of them in approximately the same plane. There's a whole bunch of reasons why. Well, electrons around a proton, let me drop. Multiple electrons around a proton are very different because the huge electrostatic charge, by comparison, charge to mass ratio of an electron is such, those individual electrons of a multiple electron atom drastically see each other and interact in funny ways, and those orbits become very complicated. Hybrid suborbitals and things like that, they're called. Eric, I think you've got some opinion on this, and you probably studied it more than me. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. K2RIW,
K2EJ. Well, a while ago, I guess it's been a couple of years now, I see that. Another interesting theory. But one thing I will say in terms of chemistry and how elements interact with each other to create molecules, the Bohr model gives you a very simple visual, you know, a kind of a visual diagram of how electrons interact between orbits and the different levels and how they connect to adjacent atoms. But the thing that I was reading is that quantum mechanics, one of the things that we've discovered is that a proton is not a single thing. It's a composite of things. And because of that, with the Bohr model, that we make the assumption that the energy surrounding what we call a proton is uniform and even. And there's this theory, because the proton is made from other particles, that the balancing forces of that, what we call the proton, is not an even distribution, and the electron has to maintain balance all the time throughout its existence surrounding that particular nucleus. That's just another theory. K2RIW, K2J.
I like what you're saying, Eric, and I'm going to add a couple of words to it. That proton is made from three quarks. I think it's two ups and one down, but three individual devices with charges of one-third and two-third magnitude. So I think there's two ups and one down, and therefore the proton is not a simple positive spherical charge center. It itself is made of multiple charges. Therefore, the field around it is not smooth. Therefore, the electron going around that proton in that hydrogen atom sees those individual pluses and minuses, and he's reacting to that more complicated electrostatic field around that proton. Is that approximately one interpretation of what you just said? KE2EJ, K2RIW, the tech man.
That's essentially what I surmised. They weren't very clear about what they were saying, but that's kind of, I don't know, maybe that's the way I thought about it, the way it appeared to me in what they were trying to communicate. But yeah, I can't see it, because it's made of quarks, because the neutrinos and the positrons and the more complex atoms, that it can't possibly be a uniform field, and that nature acquires balance all the time, and the way you do that is you follow the lines of the field.
Comment. Wes, recognize. One other point I'm going to make here, and that is, every one of us have seen diagrams of the solar system. And if you really get the diagram to scale, the distances between the planets and the sun would be so vast, and the size differences would be so vast, that you couldn't get it on the page. Therefore, they drastically exaggerate the sizes in order to make a diagram or quasi-picture. Just to give you an example, during the time that one of the recent spacecraft went between Earth and Mars, if you made a scale model of just Earth and Mars, which have roughly a 2-to-1 ratio in diameter, and convenient objects that we have that have a 2-to-1 diameter are a 50-cent piece and a dime. If I used a 50-cent piece representing the Earth and a dime representing Mars, how far apart would I have to put them so that they are the scale distance when a recent spacecraft went to Mars? And the answer is something like 4 miles. Or is it 4/10 of a mile? I think it's 4 miles. So many miles of distance between a dime and a 50-cent piece represents a scale model of just Earth and Mars at the time of interception. One other example I'm going to give you is every diagram you've ever seen of an atom or a molecule, which shows a nucleus and a cloud of electrons, is super simplistic. A nice, simple, stable atom of helium, 2 protons, 2 neutrons, and 2 electrons, a helium atom. It has an outer diameter of that shell of electrons of around an angstrom, 10 to the minus 10 meter, rough number. And so if you took that helium atom and made a scale model of it, and you blew it up the size of the Wembley Stadium in London. Wembley Stadium is 1 kilometer of circumference. 1,034 feet is the diameter of that stadium. So you made this molecule 1,034 feet in diameter, and you placed it in the middle of Wembley Stadium under its curved roof. That nucleus in the center would be a BB, 1/8 of an inch in diameter. That's the nucleus of something that's 1,034 feet in diameter. The ratio between the diameter of the nucleus and the diameter of the outer shell of electrons is 10 to the 5, 100,000 to 1. You can't represent that on a simple diagram on a piece of paper. You'll never see it. So all the diagrams you see of the solar system, almost all the diagrams you see of molecules and atoms that try to show electron cloud and nucleus, they're way out of scale. In 2XJN, we're going to have a discussion of vacuum and thermal energy later on, starting at around 11 o'clock tonight, Wes. In 2XJN, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
Yeah, I have a problem with some comments of Eric. He was mentioning the positrons, and positrons simply doesn't exist in the atom of hydrogen. Unless you're dealing with hydrogen that would be in the form of a hydrogen, a protium, deuterium, tritium, hydrogen 4, that would be the isotope. But then you may see that, okay, in tritium you have certain particles that would get out from the nucleus. Positron doesn't exist. Positron is manifestation of unhappy structure. Let me drop. Now, not every atom that is in the form of isotopic structure does have a positron emission. So I would like Eric to give something more about that. And to explain.
Yeah, you and I, Eric, have undergone medical diagnostic testing procedures, positron emission tomography, for instance. Yeah, I've had a positron emission tomography. Now, I believe they started off with a nuclear material that got injected, and then the scintillation counter, which made a picture of our organ, was using PET. Give us a couple of words on how that works, Eric. How were those positrons being emitted and detected during that medical procedure that I know I've experienced, and maybe you have? KE2EJ, K2LIW. How do they do that?
I got two things to say. I'll get to the PET scan in a second. Roughly, you have to start thinking in a more major way. For example, the radio, the resistor that you have. If you let the smoke out of the resistor, it doesn't work anymore. Well, as for the particles that make up an atom, when they're in balance, they don't give off anything. When you throw them out of balance, they give off stuff. I mean, I don't really want to get into positrons and neutrinos and things of that nature, because, you know, those are convenient theories that explain the glue that holds stuff together. And when you break it, they emit. That's the short answer to that. But the type of device that Dickie's talking about really is an array of highly sensitive photomultipliers. And let me let it drop. Okay, and that array is actually moved laterally across the body. The computer is keeping track of the position of everything. And you are injected with this material, which is thallium-113, which is a weak radioactive material. Gives off positrons, only gives off beta particles. The photomultipliers detect the presence of them because they do travel within a sort of a straight line. And the image that you actually wind up with is more like a blob as opposed to something that's distinctly visible. And the blobs really is, the point is to see what part of the heart muscle is absorbing blood and getting food and getting oxygen, and what part of the heart muscle is absent from, where there's a clog preventing the little capillaries that are fed from the coronaries that feed down the surface of the heart muscle. That's the basic idea behind it. Today we have a better method, which is a 640 slice. It's sort of a different kind of a PET scanner. It's more like an MRI, but it actually gives you a real 3D image of the heart, including the coronary vessels, where no longer do you have to go for an angiogram. You do one of these things, and you can look at this model in 3D and rotate it, and look at the individual slices, look at the thickness of the walls of the coronary vessel, and make your determinations there. You can also determine with precision the amount of calcification in the wall. K2IW, K2J.
I have a comment in addition. Yeah, we've got to move on, Wes. We're going to get into that deeper subject starting at 11 o'clock tonight. Got to go to the side issue. Let's go on to the mailbag. KC2WGB, K2IW. Go ahead, John.
Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. Very good. Alrighty. Let me let it drop and I'll pick up this first question. Okay. Have a young amateur who heard a discussion between people on this TechNet about the power level and voltage levels and the 20 dB calculation and 10 dB calculation. 10 dB power, 20 dB volts. Why is that used and how is it used? Why do you need a 20 dB calculation for the voltage, and yet with power you're referencing it to 10 dB? Maybe you could explain that for him, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
K6DPZ with a comment.
You got it, pal. K6DPZ. Let's see, this is a fairly complicated issue. Let's see how simple you can make it. That's a challenge. You got it, Al.
Hey, Dick. Challenge. Well, first of all, he has to understand the basics. If he understands the basics of what 3 dB, 6 dB, 10 dB, 20 dB, we're talking voltage or power. And the dB amounts can be added, subtracted. If he just knows the values, to go into 276 log B over A and all this other stuff, the log figuring, it's too complex. Just learn what the basic dB amounts are. 6 dB in power and voltage, 3 dB in power and voltage, 20 dB and 10 dB. And just add them and subtract them, he'll do fine. Other than that, if you start to do the calculations, we're using with a slide rule, then you're going to get into the hard way of learning it. That's my comment, Dick. I taught DB for many years in college, and I didn't make it into a complex subject, so I didn't want the students to walk out.
Yeah, there are many cases where you have to deal with really big numbers.
The power coming out of a radio transmitter might be 1,000 watts. I don't know the exact number, but 1,000 watts may be something like 300 volts RMS on a 50-ohm coaxial cable. So you're transmitting 300 volts. Your receiver, in many cases, a good sensitive receiver on a VHF frequency, might be very happy with half of a microvolt. So half of a microvolt versus 300 volts, we're talking about a ratio of more than 600 million to one. So if you try to calculate everything in power and volts, the numbers get very big. You have a whole lot of decimal places that you can't easily drop without losing the essence of what's going on. So you could say that that's one of the reasons that decibels were invented. If I'm talking about one microvolt, if I try to write it down with one and five zeros, a decimal place, five zeros, and then a one, that's a microvolt written out correctly. But if I do it with exponential mathematics, I just say 10 raised to the minus 6, and I've now got a microvolt in very compact language. And I also talk about 60 decibels per microvolt, so to speak, if that was my reference. Decibels are always with reference to something, but it's exponential mathematics that makes things easier. In most cases, a decibel reading really is power. A kilowatt transmitter is 30 decibels above 1 watt, or 60 decibels above 1 milliwatt. And so those numbers are pretty easy to write down when you're doing decibels. Let me drop. But almost all decibel readings represent a quantity of power with reference to something, usually with reference to a watt or reference to a milliwatt, or in the case of cable television, it's also in reference to a microvolt or a millivolt, but you have to know what the reference is, because decibels are always a ratio. However, once you understand what the reference power is, and somebody told you some number of decibels, if you want to convert it back into power in real watts or in milliwatts, you first take the decibel number, divide by 10, raise it to the power of 10, and call it anti-log. So when you divide by 10, you're converting a decibel unit of power into a decibel unit I said decibel. I better not use that word. It's conflicting here. You're converting it back into power that you recognize in watts or milliwatts when you first divide by 10 and then do the anti-log process. However, you know that power is a function. Let me drop. You know that power is a function of voltage squared. Power is E squared over R. So therefore, there is the square root function to convert power in, say, watts into power into volts. You're going to be doing a square root somewhere in the process, because power is voltage squared divided by resistance. So you could take your unit of power that somebody has given to you in some unit of decibels. You could divide by 10 and anti-log, and you've now got it into watts or milliwatts. Then you go through the square rooting process to convert it into voltage. You can do all that in one step by dividing by 20 instead of 10. It turns out that when you're taking a square root of a power to convert it to voltage, it really is a 2-to-1 ratio in decibels. You either divide by 20 to convert directly into volts, or you divide by 10 to convert it directly into power. It's not the whole story, but that's going to help a little bit, I think. And I'm putting myself in your shoes. If I hadn't been using it every day like I do in my business, I'll admit it's going to take a while to swallow this stuff. Don't give up. It's worth learning. The people who... Let me drop...
By the way, the original unit was called a bell.
Another very good point. The bell, which was a unit of sound in the early days, named after Alexander Graham Bell, is unfortunately a very big unit. And so we decided to use a fraction of that, a decibel, one-tenth of a bell. By the same token, capacitance is always measured in farads. A farad is a very big unit, and therefore, most often we use microfarads and nanofarads and picofarads, which are much more the right size for VHF circuits. Very rarely do you pick up a capacitor, except in the modern day, of one farad. People used to have a great big joke in the school laboratories of college in my day. You would send a naive student over to the stockroom and say, give me a 40-farad capacitor. And the guy would go trundling over there, and everybody would be laughing. 40 microfarad, maybe. 40 farads 20 years ago, not a chance. By the methods of construction in those days, it would be almost as big as the whole darn room, if you know what I mean. So decibels are a tenth of a bell. Therefore, when you divide by 10, you convert it, and then take the anti-log, you're converting back into watts. So you can do the step in one process instead of two processes when you want the answer in volts instead of power by dividing by 20. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. And by the way, your questioner is allowed to ask the question a number of different ways, a number of other times, in order to get more understanding. Lots of people have trouble with this one. Over to you, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, quite a few people do. I suggest that, if he's listening, I'm sure he is, that on the internet, if he just Googles that, he can get an awful lot of information, and then maybe he can establish some more questions and come back next week. I'll be glad to receive that question, and we'll run another one by him. Okay, now let me let it drop, and I'll go on to another one. KC2WGB. Okay, now tonight we got a young scientist. We had a question like similar to this about a year ago, but he wants to know, isn't it he? Yes, it's a he. He wants to know if a room is covered with mirrors, and he goes in there with a flashlight, and he presses the button, the light comes on, and he releases it. Why does the light seem to disappear instantaneously? Is it a question of not enough power? Would a laser make any difference? Why doesn't it flash around the room after he lets the button go? Maybe you can handle that one for him, Dick. KC2WGB, over to you.
And there's a lot of different ways of approaching this one. But the first way is to really talk about the speed of light, a nanosecond per foot. In other words, light moves 300 million meters per second. I'm not sure of the exact number, but I think it's something like going around the Earth circumference 27 times in 1 second, something like that. I know also by doing moon bounce, at the speed of light when I send my radio signal to the moon, as I've done, and it bounces off the moon and it comes back to you, it comes back in 2.5 seconds. And that is a 500,000 miles, a round trip, 250,000 miles one way, rough numbers, to the moon. So light moves awful fast. Okay. Since each foot takes a nanosecond, your room might be a 10-foot cube. So if you stood in one against one flat wall of the room, let me drop. You stood against one flat wall of the room, and you shine your laser pointer against the other wall 10 feet away. The light gets from you to that other wall in 10 nanoseconds. 10 one-billionths of a second, very fast. It's going to bounce off that mirror of that wall and come back to you in another 10 nanosecond, 10 one-billionths of a second. Each individual bounce of that light beam, because your mirror surface is nowhere near as high in reflectivity as the very exotic surfaces they use for a optical telescope parabolic mirror, or even your optical flat mirrors. You have to go through some very special procedures to try to get the reflectivity up to 0.95 or something like that. In other words, you're losing 5% of the energy, rough number, on each individual bounce of a moderately good mirror. And so the number of bounces between your two walls is billions of times per second, and you're only getting 95% of the energy on each individual bounce. therefore, that you could, with an oscilloscope and with optical detectors, let me drop, you could set up two mirrors, two really good, high-quality, spectrally flat mirrors, 10 feet apart, and you could shine a light between the two and a very brief light pulse, and with optical detectors going into a fast oscilloscope, you could watch the individual pulse bounce back and forth, and you could watch it decay. And I am guessing the decay you would see on that screen would be something in the vicinity of a microsecond. So in other words, each bounce is 20 nanoseconds. You get 50 bounces per microsecond. By the time 50 bounces has occurred, you're now probably below threshold of your detector. So in that experiment, the light is disappearing in roughly 1 microsecond. Well, normal human reaction time can barely hear something like 1 millisecond. If your voice is bouncing off a wall and you're getting an echo back at 1 millisecond, you can barely detect that as a time delay. But a time delay of 1 microsecond, you don't stand a chance. So it's making billions of bounces in the amount of time that your body can sense that the light is bouncing, so to speak. And so billions of bounces, or it's getting so weak, so fast, you don't stand a chance. I think it's going in roughly 1 microsecond. Is there a way of building a mirror that gives you higher reflectivity with fancy coatings? You can increase those numbers somewhat, but you could never make the mirror 100% reflective. If you could, in theory, yes, you could shine the light between two extremely parallel walls and walk away and come back 10 minutes later and still see that light beam bouncing back and forth. You're never going to get that higher reflectivity. It would have to be a reflectivity that's 1 minus 10 to the minus 10, if you know what I mean. It would
repeater, timeout.
You'd have to get a reflectivity of 0.9999999, 1 minus 10 to the minus 10, in order to be able to see it decaying. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. Yes. Well, if he had that type of equipment that some of us have, he would be able to look at that wave, and it would look like a dampening wave, and he would actually be able to see the reflection not ending when he turns that light off. That would be an interesting experiment. Maybe someday he'll have that kind of equipment to do that. That would be interesting. All right, let me know, drop. I have one more quick one for you. Okay, now we got our actual ham radio question here. This gentleman knows that at one time there was things called phone patch. He understands the phone 600 ohm, his microphone is 600 ohms. He would like to couple the telephone to his transmitter. Basically, what would he need to do that? He knows that he needs a switching relay, but what kind of wiring does he use? Transformers, capacitors? Maybe you could help him out with some information on that, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
You can help if you want, Dick.
Now tell me how you would do it, Eric. And I know it can be done passively. In other words, there's enough audio amplitude coming out of the telephone circuit, which could be coupled in various ways into the microphone circuit, so to speak, of a ham radio and work like a charm. It could also be done electronically, in other words, by way of a very high input impedance, field effect transistor type of operational amplifier. I could tap into the phone line wires with an impedance of an op amp that is so high that I'm absolutely not touching it. It's very similar to using a modern-day digital multimeter, which has an input impedance of 10 megohms. You connect your digital multimeter across any reasonable source of voltage, and you are not disturbing it because that meter has got such a high impedance, and there's ways you could use that to tap the audio in a non-invasive manner, and once it's into your electronics, you can do all kinds of things with it. KE2EJ, what's the best way to do it today, Eric? K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, in the area of copper wires, actually, phone company actually requires a specific interface, which is basically a transformer, a couple of diodes, a couple of capacitors. Very standard. Actually, you can break apart any modem and get yourself that lovely little transformer. And you can passively use it to couple to the radio. It gives you isolation from the line itself. So you get ground isolation. But most of the network transformers that have ever been made. You've got to consider that those really devices, they're set up to be converters. They convert from two-wire to four-wire, to the transmit side, the receive side. And they do a little funny phasing stuff so that you don't get feedback within your own phone. You still have to consider that if you're using a phone line, modern telephone modem that's providing the typical sense current, which is lets the system know that you actually have a phone off the hook, and also supplies ring voltage. You consider those things if you're going to use an FET in the front. You're going to go straight to the line. You got to remember to either keep the phone off the hook to keep the line active, or you're going to have to put I don't remember exactly what the right impedance is, but something to provide 5 milliamps of hook current, as they call it. There, of course, are phone patch devices out there that are really cheap to buy, and what we use in radio and television, when you hear somebody talking on the phone, is what we call a telephone hybrid, which actually has a circuitry in it to cancel the incoming voice from going back out, cancel the outgoing voice from coming back in. There's a little balance control, but you can get really sophisticated about it. KTRI, WKHJ.
A high percentage of our current landlines are now fiber optic wires. But back in the days when they were wired, taking the audio coming into your home from a telephone system and properly impedance matching it and connecting it to your ham radio microphone input, that part is relatively easy with an isolating transformer. In the old days, you also had to be kind of careful of the noise coming back out of your radio that you want to transmit back into the phone line. You got to make sure that that was the right amplitude. I think part of that circuitry that used to have to be used to be legal, so to speak, was to make sure that the audio you pumped back was not too great, because you could create intermodulation distortion that could, in theory, wipe out a couple of parallel phone lines as far as to the way the microwave system worked. So you had to have, I think, various limiting functions built into that phone patch to make sure the audio you sent back was not too loud. Am I even close on this one, Eric? I'm sure that the modern-day circuits, the phone itself now contains that protection circuitry. But in the old days, I think they were vulnerable to you and I plugging too much audio back into the phone line. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Yeah, that was one of the problems. That's why the clipping diodes are there. Even in the old Western Electric stuff, they used to do that. But the modern stuff is you know, you've got limiters and clippers to make sure that you don't go outside the range of the specifications of the phone line, by the way, which hasn't changed in something like 80 or 90 years. Even the modern stuff that they provide today that you plug your modular jack into, if it's a wireline type of phone, not an IP phone, still has to conform to the CCIT, whatever the numbers are, standard. So the voltage level is set, the sense current is set, the ring voltage is set. Those things, even to this day, is still the same. You can take a phone from 50 years ago and it works fine.
This is CP7.
Comment.
Yeah, how recognized? Let me ask you a quick question first, though, Eric. Those standards that we use in the United States for so-called wired phones, how universal was that to Europe? Are the European standards at least close? Over to you, Eric.
Most countries, it's quite similar. There's a couple of exceptions. I'm not sure which ones they are, whether it's still standards today, because it seems like most of the third world countries are coming up to kind of conform to the standards that the developers have created.
Okay, they're probably in a similar ballpark, but there's always going to be little differences on the, let me call it the RIAA curve, the amount of equalization, the exact voltages, and so on. K6DPZ, I bet you patches way back in the old days. K2LAW, you got it, Hal.
K2LAW, Technet K6DP, sir.
Okay, a couple things I wanted to say. First of all, generally, you do not want to overdrive a phone line with more than 0 dB as far as that goes, going into the line. And generally, in some applications, you even run it down to about neg 15. Which, well, 0 dB on one side gives you about neg 15 at the other side. Phone patches, well, I worked with a lot of hybrid phone patches, which kept isolation between the receiver and the transmitter. And nowadays, the phone patches are not really legal or used. You know, it's been a pretty mute factor. But a lot of guys build phone patches either by using resistive divider networks or by using hybrid transformers or configuring a 600 ohm primary secondary type transformers in a hybrid configuration. And hybrid means mainly when you're sending a signal out, nothing will come back. If let's say your signal is going off from the receiver, you're not going to get any signal hardly back on the mic line going back to the transmitter, but everything is going in one direction. That's my only comment. I was just reading the mail, and I designed many phone patches. They can be built very easily with some very cheap Radio Shack parts. K2RIW, K6DP7.
By the way, the 0 dB that he mentioned is, for the phone company, is at plus 8 dBm, and that's an M is a
milliwatt is 600 ohms.
So, is 0 dBm, that's what I was about to get into, is 0 dBm on a phone line, zero, in other words, exactly 1 milliwatt, 10 to the 0 power is 1. So is it exactly 1 milliwatt on a 600 ohm line, and whatever number of millivolts that represents, which I think is something like 200 millivolts, is it 1 milliwatt on a 600 ohm line? Either of you, K2LAW?
775 volts RMS on a 600 ohm line will be 1 milliwatt, if I remember my numbers correctly.
By the way, the zero, as far as the phone company is concerned, really, is it what we call zero VU, volume unit, plus 8 dBm, whereas in broadcast we use plus 4 dBm or 0 dBm.
Yeah, I'm picturing a poor guy hearing this jazz trying to make sense out of it. The craziness of decibels is you can have positive decibels and negative decibels. The negative decibels are the weaker ones, the positive decibels are the stronger ones, and 0 decibel is not zero signal. It's just a one-to-one reference to whatever your reference value is, which might be, in the case of a phone system, it might be a milliwatt of voltage slash power on a 600 ohm impedance circuit. In the case of TBMV, it might be with reference to 1 millivolt on a 75 ohm transmission line. When it comes to cable TV, decibels become negative, positive, and 0 decibels is a real amount of power, a real amount of voltage, and 0 decibels is not zero signal, which at first sounds kind of crazy. Maybe with any further comments on all of the above, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, if you want to make someone crazy, we have CBI and DBC.
When it comes to the nomenclature, DB, in other words, small, lowercase d, larger, uppercase b, which means decibel, a tenth of a bell. And by the way, I've occasionally made measurements in micro decibels, which are really microbells, or one-tenth microbells and nanobells. You can have a lot of fun with that. And how many nanokilomegadollars that you have in your pocket, you can have a lot of fun with these units. But what I'm getting at is that lowercase d, uppercase b, followed by one other letter, or sometimes more than one other letter, can give you references of power, voltage, isotropic antennas, reference levels of intermodulation, distortion product, amplitudes, read on a spectrum analyzer screen. That's quite often DBC. DBI is DB with reference to isotropic, talking about gain of an antenna. There's a zillion kinds of DB something. There's probably 50 of them all together. I once saw a list that was appearing in the
AIL Record monthly newspaper of Airborne Instruments Laboratory. They once had a list of all the kinds of decibels, and boy, there's a lot of them. And when they have any comments, K2RIW.
BUS 2N.
Go right ahead, Paul. And I bet you've wondered some crazy questions about decibels over the years. Go ahead, Paul.
I sure have, but you could always, you know, it's probably a young guy doing this, like you said before, and he could just refer to the exponential, you know, and just tell him that, you know, the three, you know, the exponent three is 1,000, which is really like three zeros after the one. The two, you know, for the exponent two is really 100, which is two zeros, and then one exponent one would be 1 0, and that is zero, you know, and that would be doing, you know, 0 0. So what do you got? Now you got just the one left. Maybe they would understand that better there.
Yeah, if you go to the various websites, you'll see a list of the real number in the left-hand column and the decibel number in the right-hand column, or vice versa. And when you see the number of zeros before or after the decimal point, it makes a little more sense. And so we amateurs tend to memorize the power ratio and or voltage ratio of a number of particular kinds of decibels. We know that 10 decibels represents a 10-to-1 power ratio between whatever's the reference and whatever you're measuring. So if my 1 volt happened to be my dBV, in other words, I've decided to set up a set of units that I call dBV, lowercase d, uppercase b, and maybe lowercase v, Victor. And I decided that 1 volt is my reference. 1 volt would be 0 dBV. 10 volts would be, you got to be careful now. You got to decide whether or not you're going to be representing power or voltage. I better not go there. Life's getting complicated. I shouldn't have used voltage, but there are dBVs, and it can create a lot of confusion. So lots of different kinds of decibels, and when it comes to adding up the gains of a chain of a system, in other words, I might have a transmitter. Let me drop. Which starts off with a voltage-controlled oscillator on this FM transmitter. And that voltage-controlled oscillator might start off with 1 milliwatt of output that can be FM modulated. Now I'd call that 0 dBm, 1 milliwatt. dBm with reference to milliwatt. And it goes through a number of amplification stages and frequency converting stages of the transmitter. And by the time the signal comes out, it maybe goes through three separate stages of 20 decibels each, and therefore 20 plus 20 plus 20 is 60. I eventually come out with 60 dBm at the antenna port of this transmitter. That's a kilowatt, 60 dBm. I memorized that as a kilowatt. Then the signal goes through free space. And if I was going through one way to the moon, where the signal might lose 120 decibels, plus 60 dB coming out of the transmitter, 120 decibels of loss. By the time the signal gets to the moon, it's minus 60 dBm. And then it's going to be going into an antenna on the moon that's got 10 dB of gain. That's got it going to the first stage of a receiver that's got 10 dB of gain. And you can add and subtract these decibels, and it's fairly easy to figure out the whole path between the microphone or the local oscillator, we drop, and this transmitter that's sending signals to the moon, being picked up by an antenna on the moon, going through various stages of the receiver on the moon, and eventually coming out to the earphones that are connected to the astronaut's helmet on the moon, so to speak. You can add and subtract those decibels, and it becomes a relatively simple diagram. If you try to do that with real watts of power, or real volts, you would be writing down huge big numbers and huge big and little numbers in order to describe that path, and you could easily drop a few decimal places and never even know it, and
come up with answers that are pretty crazy. So decibels does save you quite a bit of time in doing quick back-of-the-envelope understanding of receivers and transmitters. The average receiver that you guys are ever going to use in radio service usually has approximately 120 decibels of gain between the antenna port and the loudspeaker. It's a nice, convenient number to measure, to remember, 120 decibels, which happens to be the number of, I believe it's a trillion to one, yes. I think the amount of gain between the antenna port and the loudspeaker is close to a trillion to one on the average receiver. A trillion to one is a big number. 120 decibels is easy to write down. Gives you a little bit of a feeling of why. Let me drop. People who live with radios really live with decibels. When it comes to the amplitudes of signals that you measure off a spectrum analyzer, 98% of those answers are decibels in milliwatts, microvolts, decibels with reference to the carrier, DBC, and so 90-some-odd percent of all the measurements people make off of a spectrum analyzer are decibel readings. A high percentage of the numbers people come off of a vector network analyzer are decibel readings. When a person is using a service monitor, quite often the answers are in decibels. I'll admit that when a person is using a bird directional power meter, bird watt meter we call it, there people will quite often talk about forward power in watts and reverse power in watts, and sometimes to convert them to decibels. So it's one of the cases where decibels are not quite as popular. But 90-some-odd percent of the radio equipment you're likely to use as an amateur or as a professional in the business are going to be decibel-related values. Therefore, if you take the time to study what decibels are and become familiar with them, you'll have a leg up in working with that group of people or that industry. Let me drop. And one other thing I was starting to get at earlier, the usual rule of thumb people use is that they burn into their memory that a decibel ratio of 3 dBs, plus 3 dBs is 3 dB of gain, 3 dBs is a 2 to 1 ratio, usually power. So if I'm going into an amplifier with 3 dB of gain, that means the power coming in out of that amplifier is going to be twice the power that went in. 6 dB of gain is a 4 to 1 ratio. I put a tenth of a watt into that 6 dB gain amplifier, I'm going to get 4 tenths of a watt coming out of that amplifier. 10 dB is a 10 to 1 ratio. I put 1 milliwatt into this amplifier, with 10 dB of gain, I'm going to get 10 milliwatts of output. 20 dB is a 100 to 1 ratio, as Paul was giving us as an example earlier. So 1 milliwatt going into a 20 dB gain amplifier is going to come out as 100 milliwatts coming out, 100 to 1 gain, 20 dB. 30 dB is a 1,000 to 1 gain. So 30 dB, 20 dB, 10 dB, 6 dB, 3 dB, those are the numbers that people usually memorize. You go one step further and memorize that 5 dB is a 7 to 1 power ratio. That one's if I got that one right? I'm not right on that one. Let's see. 7 dB, where do I run into that one? With hybrids. I won't go there right now. Yeah. Obviously, I didn't do a good job of remembering that one. 5 dB. 5 dB, I think, is a 7 to 1 ratio. Nope. 6 dB is a 4 to 1 ratio. 5 dB is probably a 3 to 1 ratio. It sounds right. 3 and a fraction ratio. So, there are certain numbers that people memorize. I wonder if you have one more that you want to cover, or do you think we should go on? It's up to you, John. KC2WGB with the mailbag. And
repeater, timeout.
And John, since you were also monitoring the internet tonight, I said internet, I mean Echo Link, was there anybody trying to get an edge of WordWise with Echo Link, and how many people did you see signed in? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. On Echo Link, we had 6, no questions. And the chat room, we had 3 or 4, no questions on the chat room either. So it's been a little quiet, and that's it from the mailbag tonight. So we'll go over to Paul for his space report, and we'll see what Voyager is doing. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Okay, next up at bat is Paul, WS2N. Well, I'm guessing is going to give us space report number 138 of the series. That began way back in, well, to a certain degree, it began when Paul was a youngster crawling around.